But now here's Bill Resnick talking with Bill McKibben, the founder of 350.org.
Thanks, Tom. Bill McKibben, welcome to KABU.
Always good to be at KABU.
Bill McKibben is on a book tour. You'll be speaking at the Baghdad Theater. It's at 37th and Southeast Hawthorne. It's tonight at 7 o'clock. It's actually a wake-up tour for his book, Earth, Making a Life in a Tough Planet, on a Tough Planet. It's a powerful, stunning book with staggering implications, actually, at least for me. In the first half of the book, he very soberly and convincingly demonstrates that unless we begin mobilizing now for a crash program to reduce greenhouse gases, we on Earth are headed towards a unimaginable and inescapable catastrophe. The second half of the book discusses what could be done to build a livable, sustainable society, very different than how we live now, necessarily dispersed and localized, but still to make a life on a very tough and not very hospitable and surely not as comfortable planet as we have now. Bill McKibben, let's start with the terrible threat that no one at leadership levels of this country, but for a few military planners, except for the military planners, no one's willing to face it. You're one of the people who is trying to get them to see it.
It's hard for us to think that the quite comfortable and cozy Earth that we were born onto is shifting. In a sense, that's why I gave this book the odd title, The Earth, but spelled with an extra A in the middle. Our planet still has the same number of continents. Gravity still applies, but in fundamental ways, it is shifting. The air already holds about 5% more water vapor because warm air holds more water vapor than cold. That means we get these wicked downpours and deluges and floods. Rio, 2 weeks ago, had the worst rainstorms in its history. Thousands dead, tens of thousands homeless. That's a pattern that you can find almost everywhere around the world every week now. The ocean is 30% more acid than it used to be. Huge parts of the Arctic are now frozen, melted, missing. You know, the Earth looks different from outer space than it did just a few years ago. We're changing very, very fast.
And in these changes have tremendous implications for human health, for land arability. Why don't you go into the production of food?
Yeah, I think that's maybe, I think you may be touching on the one that in the long run may be the most profound of all. There's a lot of new data already showing that we're getting pretty significant shortfalls in grain production because the weather is getting so strange. The amount of grain grown per capita on this planet peaked in about 1995 and has gone downhill since. There are new studies demonstrating that if the planet, as the planet warms over the course of this century, as scientists expect, we'll see falls in production from corn and beans and wheat and rice of 20, 30, 40%, truly unimaginable. And of course, that's one of the reasons.
Enormous. What that implies is mass starvation.
Well, that's of course one of the reasons that the Pentagon is starting to think about these things. That's a world of great chaos because people will be doing all they can to access food somehow. And it's also a world of great chaos because people will be in motion all over the planet.
Indeed. Enormous migrations, especially with sea levels rising. You have billions of people who are going to be disrupted and displaced, and not just in the poor countries. Long Island, Florida, Louisiana, the Gulf Coast, Southern California.
India just finished building a 2,500-mile-long wall between it and Bangladesh because they know there's 150 million people there squeezed by the Bay of Bengal looking for someplace new to go.
Yeah, the people on Long Island, there's only 2 or 3 million, I suppose, there who are going to be displaced. But Florida is 30 million, perhaps, or something like that. The Gulf Coast, vast numbers of people are going to be.
So these places are so rich that it's possible we'll be able to, for a while, shield them from that kind of displacement, but the cost will be extraordinarily high. And that's one of the points that I try to make. It's, you know, 40 years ago, when that team at MIT published what they were calling the limits to growth, everybody poo-pooed it. Oh, we'll always figure out something. we're running into those limits, and those limits are expensive. They're putting friction, Bill, on this planet that there didn't used to be. You know, Tom Friedman spent the last few years extolling the virtues of the flat earth on which we now live, where everything is easy to get from one place to another. Even if that was true when he said it 10 years ago, it's not true any longer. This is an uphill planet. And if you have any doubt about it, don't even ask the scientists, ask the insurance companies.
Yeah, who are refusing to insure.
There's vast swaths of the world already where you can't get insurance.
And the costs of that, of course, are then going to be put on the public, obviously, of many, many different kinds. The people on Long Island are first going to try and save themselves, which they can't do, but they're going to be have enough power, and the cement companies and all the rest of them, to spend vast amounts of money that could be spent towards
the transition to renewable energy that would get us somewhere out of this problem.
Yeah.
Think about the ways in which we've managed to, I mean, this is not so unlike our financial crisis. It's another one of these too big to fail scenarios, this time not our banking system as much as our energy and agriculture system. Well, what we've done is privatized all the profit in that industry. ExxonMobil made more money each of the last 3 years than any company in the history of money, but we've socialized the cost of it. Exxon's business model has been to treat the atmosphere as an open sewer in which they can pour carbon without any cost at all for a very long time.
Yeah, let's though get back to some of the other costs, because adding up the cost, it becomes what we begin seeing is the enormous need to change. The cost of disease is going to go up. There's tremendous, as temperatures rise, mosquitoes become much more capable.
All kinds
of diseases. Forests dying from diseases.
So on the West Coast, we see, you know, millions of acres of dead pine trees. Yeah. But, you know, I got that sense of that firsthand when I was in Bangladesh not long ago and they were having their first big outbreak of mosquito-borne dengue. I got it. I highly recommend not getting it. But I didn't die because I was healthy going in. Lots of people did. What's more, they had to sort of divert the entire public health system of the country to dealing with this new threat. Suddenly there wasn't the money for family planning or AIDS prevention or all the other things that we need to be doing, because all people were doing was trying to keep dengue sufferers alive.
You know, another cost that you talk about in your book is these storms are enormously expensive in terms of that no one's going to reproduce, I guess, some of the homes in New Orleans or in the areas of Florida that are being destroyed by constant hurricanes. That's not going to be rebuilt because you can't get financing for that. But there's the whole infrastructure of Louisiana was enormously destroyed. It's cost huge amounts, huge billions and billions and billions of dollars just to sort of repair sewerage stuff that's going to be destroyed again.
Right. We just set up the pins again for the next day of bowling. And what's really powerful is it's not just those most dramatic examples. All around the world, what engineers used to call the 100-year storm now come every 3 or 4 years. I tell the story in the book of the tiny town where I live
in
Vermont.
Your community is now deeply indebted because it had to.
We had the two worst rainstorms we've ever had about 6 weeks apart. They washed out the road to town. The governor had to come visit on a helicopter. You know, the state and federal taxpayers are putting $2 million into building a new road to get to the top of a hill where 500 people live. Well, you know, you add up that enough times, you begin to get to real money.
Yeah, all of these costs are, and people are demanding it, and politicians are providing it and bonding the debt, of course, and we're all going to be paying for it. And, of course, we're paying for a military who is now more and more seeing themselves as disaster specialists.
Right.
They're planning now for more and more disasters.
Right.
There's all of this money flowing in to meet the, sort of the symptoms of the disaster and very little being used to prevent the greenhouse gases that are intensifying the potentials for catastrophe.
Right. As usual, we treat the symptoms and not the cause. And the reason for that is that it would mean doing something serious about fossil fuel. And fossil fuel is the most profitable business in the world, and hence extremely well defended. So well defended that only a really strong people's movement will be enough to get real legislation, which is what we've been trying to build at 350.org.
Right. That's the second half of our interview. We're moving right towards it. We're going to take a break now. Back to Tom Becker, who's our host today. Are we going to play a little music? Is that it? And give people a little rest, and then we'll get back to Bill McKibben. Let him take a deep breath. There really are sort of solutions. You'll never live the way we're living now again, but the solutions would lead to a livable life if we can build the movement that Bill just introduced. So a little music break with Michelle Schacht, and then back here.
What have they done to the earth? What have they done to our fair sister? Ravaged and plundered and ripped her and bit her. Stuck her with knives in the side of the dawn and tied her with fences and dragged her down. I hear a very gentle sound. With your ear down to the ground. We want the world and we want it.
We want now. The world and we want it.
Now.
Well, for you Michelle Schacht fans, you probably realize that wasn't her. That was actually The Doors with a little snippet from a song called When the Music's Over. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This is the Old Mo Variety Hour. And now back to Bill Resnick's interview with Bill McKibben, the founder of 350.org.
Yes, this is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland. I'm talking to Bill McKibben, who in 1989 wrote the book The End of Nature. He's now discussing his new book. He'll be at the Baghdad Theater tonight at 7. His new book is Earth, with two A's. The Earth has irrevocably changed. His new book is Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. This is the second half of the interview. In the first half, we talked about the impacts, the inevitable and inescapable impacts of climate change now, particularly lowered food production, disease, huge storms, all of them enormously costly. And the costs are, for all of them, are depleting the possibilities of actually responding to the underlying problem. In the second half of the interview, we're going to be talking about what can be done. Bill, it's actually, in some ways, it's a very sober book. It's also conversational. It's completely convincing, but it also has a lot of hope. Not a hope for restoring what we have now, but hope for creating kinds of societies that would be livable in a much less comfortable and hospitable climate. So, Bill McKibben, what do you see as the? We're never going to get back to what we had, but we could live reasonably well.
So, we got to get rid of the idea that we're always going to be able to use growth to get out of every problem we fall into. Part of this is sheer psychological. We need a new set of metaphors. Because we're so used to growth in this society. Stability, resilience, these have got to be our watchwords. We've got too many systems that are too big to fail, and we've got to start breaking them down and spreading them out. So Portland's a terrific example. Look at our food system. It's been as centralized as our energy system or our broadcasting system or anything else for a very long time. But now we see the first glimmers of change, the real local food movement that's been enough, first in Oregon and now around the country, in the last 5 years to actually increase the number of farms for the first time in a century and a half. That's good news. It's a small start on the direction that we need to go. a start that will be amplified and accelerated the day that we do the one key political task, which is make fossil fuel bear the cost for the damage it does in the environment. When that happens, the farmers market will be as economically obvious as it is socially and aesthetically obvious at the moment.
You see the small farm and the small farming community as kind of the base and creating local growing places even within large cities, as in fact we're finding all over the United States and particularly in Havana, Cuba, apparently.
That's right. I've spent some time in Havana looking at, they're growing most of the food they eat in Havana in Havana. And the same is true in many places around the world, including super sophisticated megalopolises like Shanghai. You know, the surrounding counties support most of – and in this country, about two-thirds of the food is grown in counties adjacent to metropolitan areas. The thing is, it just disappears into the commodity food stream at the moment. We've gotten rid of all the infrastructure, the slaughterhouses, the canneries, all the things that made it possible for New Jersey to be the garden state, say. Bringing that back is not only possible, it's pretty much mandatory at this point.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the farms, it is good that there are now the endless sort of expansion of huge concentrated farming has sort of gone to its...
Begun to wane.
And there are a lot more small farms, but some of that is, unfortunately, it seems to me, the fruit of this sort of artificial wealth that we've created that will disappear. But a lot of boutique sort of places that are farms and actually even make money, but they sell on the sort of boutique market. And still the basic grains, the basic calories that people eat are being produced and by cutting down the Amazon, temporarily producing food, right? By mining the water of the Great Plains, temporarily producing food.
The good news is... And this is a lot of new agricultural research in the last 10 years. It makes it clear that for almost any crop in almost any place in the world, you get better yield when you have a smaller farm. What we need to be doing is replacing the fossil fuel that's dominated our agricultural system for a century with more human hands. Now, we're never going to go back to 50% of Americans on the farm, but at the moment, there's about 1% of Americans. There are twice as many people as in prison as there are growing our food, which says something about both our prisons and our farms,
yeah,
I'm afraid.
Yeah, it sure does.
But for any of this to happen in the time that we have at the speed that we need a real political movement because we're losing in the larger sense right now. And that's why we've been building this thing at 350.org. The number comes from what scientists tell us this is the most carbon we can have in the atmosphere. And last October, we coordinated this, our first attempt at a kind of global campaign day. One day in October, we had 5,200 demonstrations in 181 countries. CNN called it the most widespread day of political action on any issue in the planet's history.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour talking to Bill McKibben about climate change, the inevitability of really catastrophic events, and the necessity of tremendous change of our lifestyles. We're talking about that. It's possible, actually. The technology exists. It's the political struggle that counts. Before we get into the basics of the political struggle, though, one other change you talked about that I think is absolutely necessary is radically changing our energy system, very radically towards solar and wind and towards local dispersed solar and wind versus big utility solar and wind.
So this is the natural effect of beginning to – one of the reasons we have such centralized economic system – is because of fossil fuel. The very physics and chemistry of it, you know, it's rich in BTUs, it's concentrated in a few places in the world, it's easy to transport. It's no wonder that we ended up with, you know, a few huge electric power stations burning coal, and so on and so forth. The logic of renewable energy is exactly the opposite. It's present everywhere, but it's always diffuse and dispersed. And so you need a kind of almost a farmer's market in energy. I have solar panels all over my roof in Vermont. On a sunny day, I'm a utility. I'm firing electrons down the grid. My neighbor, you know, cools his beer with the sunlight that falls on my shingles. That's good. It not only is more ecologically benign, it's a hell of a lot more resilient than the very vulnerable system we've got at the moment.
We need a smart grid, but not their smart grid, which is going to indebt us further, huge costs, huge plants, huge amounts of power produced, but a lot of it's lost in transmission over these huge areas that they want. The big utility model is going to destroy us, even if it's just solar and wind sourced.
So the real thing to do would be take advantage of these new sources in order to change some of the ways we think about and use energy, which at the moment is carelessly.
It seems to me pretty clear that local public utilities, but also these local movements towards changing the energy structure and local agriculture, both of them involve people sufficiently so that they could be the core of that political movement that would change national priorities and redeploy wealth. I'm not sure where it would come from. What's the agency for that political change?
It's really important that it be happening, you know, at a local level. But in the very short period of time we got, we need national action and international action to change the price of carbon, because that then makes it so people need to be doing 80% of their effort close to home, doing things in Portland, building on all the, you know, neighborhood repair movement that, you know, really blossomed in this place. But we need you to save some of your energy for working on this national and global level. October 10th of this year, 10-10-10, we're having another one of these huge global days, this time not a political rally, this time a global work party. All over the world, people will be doing the kind of local work you describe, putting up solar panels, digging community gardens, not because, Bill, there's any way to solve this problem one project at a time. Its scale is too large and its time is too short. We need that legislation. The pointed political message that will be coming from these global work parties is, if we can get to work, then our putative leaders can get to work too. If I can get up on the roof and hammer in a solar panel, then my senator should be able to rise to the floor of the Senate and hammer out some legislation, which is his job after all.
That is, we have to sort of tax carbon and use that money to change the whole energies. Whatever way we do it, even cap and trade, if you sell the... You have to tax that carbon, it seems to me, to create the...
Carbon has to carry the price for the damage that it does. And until we get that piece of information into the system, then we're just running blind.
Yeah, one final thing I think that has to be discussed that you point out in your book that's so important. Even if we do something in the United States, even if we did all of this that we talked about in the United States, we fail because the rich world is going to have to accumulate resources for the poor like China, India, Africa, or they're going to use their coal to try and survive,
right,
and oil, and it's going to and whatever we do, it gets negated. And that is, we really do have to, because we've done this, the rich world, we have to accumulate wealth, and that's going to even be harder because we're
not in a very generous mood right now. Think, though, about this dilemma if you're in China or India. You've got 600-800 million people living in bitter rural poverty. The easiest way to pull them out is to burn the cheap coal that we burned for 100 years to build our prosperity. But we're telling them, sorry, the atmosphere's already filled up. Figure out some other way. Well, that's fundamentally not fair. The Chinese, the Indians, and everybody else, on the other hand, are practical people too. They realize that they have a severe problem if climate change gets out of control. So they're willing to at least meet us halfway. The Chinese are investing far more money in green energy right now than we are, much to our shame and to our eventual economic distress, I think. But that global coalition is what we're trying hard to build at 350.org. When we got to Copenhagen, we managed to get 117 nations signed on to that 350 target. They were, however, the wrong 117 nations. They were the poorest and most vulnerable ones, not the most addicted nations. And so we still have a lot of work to do.
Particularly in the U.S., actually.
Particularly in the U.S. There's no question that this is where, this is where the problem started. And at some level, it's where it will or will not be addressed. There's a bill that'll be introduced in Congress next week in the Senate, but it's a pretty darn weak one, unfortunately.
It's really worth fighting around, though, it seems to me, and trying to strengthen it enormously, if not this year, next year, or whenever.
Some sooner or later, and hopefully sooner, because the physics and chemistry of climate change don't give us any leeway. Part of the problem, of course, is we've let it become an entirely, like everything else in our country, an entirely ideological and partisan debate. And that's understandable because the right wing has been so intransigent. But the idea that this is a normal political question is just wrong. It's not, in the end, a debate between liberals and conservatives or Democrats and Republicans. It's a debate between human beings on the one hand and physics and chemistry on the other. And that's an awfully tough debate to win, you know. Physics and chemistry are not going to change their method of operation because it's inconvenient for us, which it is inconvenient for us.
Politically here, though, we have to build those movements.
I couldn't agree more.
And I mean, that's you've made that your life purpose. And we have to build those movements, and they're going to be resisted. We see right now fearful people being manipulated and goaded and given ammunition by both right-wing forces and the industries who would be affected, the worst predators. And we see this huge amounts of fear and resistance to change and resistance to taxes and resistance to any kind of public requirement to do precisely what has to be done, which is to redeploy our wealth. How do we reach those people? You know, I think the military might be our best hope for reaching those people. When the military says, we're in deep crisis.
Houston, we have a problem.
We have to really change everything. We only have another minute left. What's your sense? How do we reach the American public? They don't want to listen.
60 or 70% of Americans know that there is a serious problem with climate change. What we've got to do is activate some reasonable part of those people into real involvement. If you've spent your life marinating in Rush Limbaugh, then you're beyond the point of salvation at this point. But most people aren't like that. Most people are reachable. Most people care about their children's future. We've got to keep building things like 350.org. We've got to do it very quickly.
Very quickly.
And, you know, I mean, if you were a betting person, you might bet that we'd waited too long. But that's not a bet you're allowed to make. We've got to do this work.
Yeah, optimism of the will.
There you are.
And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour, Bill Resnick talking to Bill McKibben. Bill's going to be talking. You do want to hear him tonight at the Baghdad at 7 o'clock, the Baghdad Theater. It's on 37th and Southeast Hawthorne. Thanks a lot for talking to us, Bill, today.
My pleasure, and thank you for the example of kind of community building that KBOO has been for so long. We're really grateful for it out in the rest of the country.
Well, thank you for that.